You won't be able to control the grinding of your teeth. You're certain to break a few. The excessive salivation will occur, and finally, breathing difficulties. If I don't give you the antidote, you'll suffocate. But don't worry. I shall. You'll live. For now. But I think you'll soon regret that you've survived. I'll explain what it's all about. We have time. But first, I'd like to watch you turning blue. I was observing you on the last day of June, during the audience, he continued a moment later. You flaunted your arrogance before us. Before us. People a hundredfold your betters. People you're no match for. Playing with fire amused and excited you. I saw that. It was then that I determined to prove to you that playing with fire will get you burned, and interfering in matters of magic and mages has equally painful consequences. You'll soon find out for yourself. Geralt tried to move, but couldn't. His limbs and entire body were paralyzed and insensitive. He felt an unpleasant tingling in his fingers and toes. His face was completely numb, and his lips felt like they were laced together. His vision was deteriorating. His eyes were misting over, and a cloudy mucus was gluing them together. Dagelund crossed his legs and swung the medallion. There was a symbol on it, an emblem in blue enamel. Geralt didn't recognize it. His eyesight was getting worse. The sorcerer hadn't lied. The disturbance to his sight was intensifying. The thing is, you see, that I plan to go far in the sorcerer's hierarchy, Dagelund continued casually. In my designs and plans, I'm relying on Ortolan, who's known to you from your visit to Risberg and the memorable audience. Geralt had the sensation that his tongue was swelling and filling his entire mouth. He was afraid it wasn't just a sensation. The venom of the white scorpion was lethal. He'd never previously been exposed to its action, and didn't know how it might affect his witch's body. He was seriously worried, desperately fighting the toxin that was destroying him. The situation didn't look good. It appeared he couldn't expect help from anywhere. "A few years ago," said Sorrel Dagelund, still delighting in the sound of his own voice, "I became Ortolan's assistant. The chapter assigned me to the post, and the Risberg research team approved it. I was, like my predecessors, to spy on Ortolan and sabotage his more dangerous ideas. I didn't owe my assignment merely to my magical talent, but also to my looks and personal charm, for the chapter would supply the old man with the kind of assistance he was fond of. You may not know, but during the times of Ortolan's youth, misogyny and the fashion for male friendship, which very often turned into something more, or even something much more, were rife among sorcerers. That it happened that a young pupil or novice didn't have a choice, had to be obedient to his seniors in this regard, as with all others. Some of them didn't like it very much, but had to take it as it came, and some acquired a liking for it. As you've probably guessed, Ortolan belonged to the latter. The boy, whose avian nickname fitted him then, became, after the experiences with his preceptor, a lifelong enthusiast and champion of noble male friendship and love, as poets would have it. It would be defined in prose more bluntly and crudely, as you know. A large black cat, with its tail fluffed up like a brush and purring loudly, rubbed itself against the sorcerer's calf. Dagelund leaned over, stroked it, and swung the medallion in front of it. The cat swatted the medallion casually with its paw. It turned away, signalling that the game was boring it, and set about licking the fur on its chest. "As you've doubtless observed," continued the sorcerer, "I have exceptional looks, and women have been known to call me an Ithebe. I'm fond of women, indeed, but in principle I didn't, and don't have anything against homosexuality. Under one condition, if it is to be, it must help me to advance my career. My physical intimacy with Ortolan didn't demand excessive sacrifices. The old man had long passed both the age limit for capability and desire. But I did my best for people to think otherwise, and believe he'd utterly fallen for me. Believe there was nothing he would refuse his gorgeous lover. Believe that I knew his codes, that I had access to his secret books and notes, that he was giving me artifacts and talismans he hadn't previously revealed to anyone, and that he was teaching me forbidden spells, including Goetia. And if previously the great men and women of Risberg had disdained me, now they suddenly began to esteem me. I had grown in their eyes. They believed I was doing what they themselves dreamed of, and that I was achieving success. Do you know what transhumanism is? What kind of specialization it is? Radiation? Speciation? Introgression? No. There's nothing to be ashamed of. I don't really either. But everybody thinks I know a great deal. That under the tutelage and auspices of Ortolan, I'm conducting research into perfecting the human race, with the lofty goal of refining and improving it, to improve the human condition, to eliminate illness and disability, to banish the aging process, blah, blah, blah. For that is the goal and task of magic, to follow the path of the great masters, Malaspina, Altsor, and Idaren, the masters of hybridization, mutation, and genetic modification. Announcing its arrival by meowing, the black cat appeared again. It jumped into the sorcerer's lap, stretched and purred. Dagoland stroked it rhythmically. The cat purred even louder, extending claws of truly tiger-like proportions. You surely know what hybridization is, for it's another word for cross-breeding. The process of obtaining crossbreeds, hybrids, bastards, it's all the same. They actively experiment with that at Risberg. They've produced endless peculiarities, monsters and sports. Some find wide practical applications, like, for example, parazugals, cleaning municipal dust heaps, para-woodpeckers, keeping down tree parasites and mutated gambeses, feeding on the larvae of malarial mosquitoes, or vigilosaurs, guard lizards, the killing of which you bragged about during the audience. But they consider them trifles, byproducts. What really interests them is the hybridization and mutation of people and humanoids. That is forbidden, but Risberg disregards prohibitions. And the chapter turns a blind eye to it. Or, which is more likely, it remains immersed in blissful, dull ignorance. Malaspina, Altsor, and Idaren, it has been proved, took small, ordinary creatures to their workshops to create giants from them, like those centipedes, spiders, koshkis, and the devils know what else. What, then, they asked, stands in the way of taking an ordinary little man and transforming him into a titan, into something stronger, able to work 20 hours a day, who's unaffected by illness, who can live fully fit to 100? It's known that they wanted to do it. Apparently, they managed to. Apparently, they were successful. But they took the secret of their hybrids to the grave. Even Ortolan, who has devoted his life to studying their works, has achieved little. Boo and Bang, who dragged you here, have you observed them? They're hybrids, magical crosses of ogres and trolls. The marksman pastor? No, in fact he is, so to speak, in the likeness and image, the completely natural result of a cross between a hideous woman and an ugly man. But Boo and Bang, they came straight out of Ortolan's test tubes. You may ask, why the hell would anyone want such hideous creatures? What the hell would you create something like that for? I didn't know that myself until quite recently. Until I saw how they ripped the woodcutters and charcoal burners apart. Boo is capable of wresting someone's head from their shoulders with one tug. And Bang can tear a child apart like a roast chicken. And if you give them some sharp tools, then they can achieve a rip-roaring bloodbath. When you ask Ortolan, he says that hybridization is meant to be a way of eliminating hereditary illnesses and witters on about increasing immunity to infectious diseases or some such old fogies nonsense. I know better. And you do too. Specimens like Boo and Bang and the thing you tore Idaren's plate off are only fit for one thing. Killing. And that's good, because what I needed were killing tools. I wasn't certain about my own skills and capabilities in that regard. Unjustly, as a matter of fact, as it later transpired. But the sorcerers of Risberg go on cross-breeding, mutating, and genetically modifying from dawn to dusk. And they've had numerous successes. They've produced so many hybrids it takes your breath away. They think all of them are useful, meant to make people's lives easier and more pleasant. Indeed, they're one step away from creating a woman with a perfectly flat back, so you can fuck her from behind and have somewhere to put a glass of champagne and play solitaire at the same time. But let's return ad rem, that is, to my scientific career. Not having any tangible successes to boast of, I had to create semblances of those successes. It was easy. Do you know that other worlds, different from ours, exist, which the conjunction of the spheres cut off access to? Universes, called elemental and para-elemental planes, inhabited by creatures called demons? The accomplishments of Altsor et consortes were excused by saying they had gained access to those planes and creatures, that they'd managed to invoke and tame such creatures, that they'd wrested from them and gained possession of their secrets and knowledge. I think that's all nonsense and fabrication, but everybody believes it. And what can one do when faith is so strong? In order for people to believe I was close to discovering the secrets of the old masters, I had to convince Risberg that I know how to invoke demons. Ortolan, who'd once successfully carried out Goetia, didn't want to teach me that art. He had an insultingly low opinion of my magical abilities, and made me remember where my place was. Why? For the good of my career? I'll remember that. They'll see. The black cat, weary of being stroked, hopped off the sorcerer's lap. He swept a cold glance of his golden, wide-open eyes over the witcher, and walked away, tail held aloft. Geralt was having more and more difficulty breathing and felt shivers shooting through his body, which he couldn't control at all. The situation looked grave, and only two circumstances augured well, giving him reason to hope. Firstly, he was still alive, and where there's life, there's hope, as his preceptor in Caer Morhen, Vesemir, used to say. The second circumstance that augured well was Dagolan's swollen ego and conceitedness. It seemed the sorcerer had fallen in love with his own words as a young man, and they were clearly the love of his life. Unable thus to become a goetic practitioner, the sorcerer went on, twisting the medallion and endlessly delighting in his own voice, I had to pretend to be one. Pretend? It's known that a demon invoked by a goetic practitioner often breaks free and wreaks destruction. So I did just that. Several times. I slaughtered several settlements, and they believed it was a demon. You'd be astonished how gullible they are. I once decapitated a peasant I had caught and sewed the head of a large goat onto his neck using biodegradable catgut, disguising the stitches with plaster and paint. After that, I displayed it to my learned colleagues as a Baphomet, the result of an extremely difficult experiment in the field of creating humans with animal heads. Only a partly successful one because the end result didn't survive. They believed me. Just imagine. I rose even higher in their esteem. They're still waiting for me to create something that will survive. I confirmed their belief in this by constantly sewing some head or other onto a decapitated corpse. But that was a digression. Where was I? Ah, the massacred settlements. As I expected, the masters of Risberg took them as acts of demons or energumens possessed by them. But I made a mistake. I went too far. No one would have bothered with one settlement of woodcutters, but we slaughtered several. Bew and Bang did most of the work, but I also contributed as much as I could. In the first colony, yew trees or some such, I didn't exactly distinguish myself. When I saw what Bew and Bang were doing, I vomited, puking all over my cloak. It was only fit to be thrown away. A cloak of the best wool, trimmed with silver mink. It cost almost 100 crowns. But then I did better and better. Firstly, I attired myself suitably, like a labourer. Secondly, I grew fond of those expeditions. It turned out there can be great pleasure in chopping off somebody's legs and watching the blood spurting from the stump, or gouging out somebody's eye, or tugging a handful of steaming guts from a mutilated belly. I shall be brief. Along with today's haul, it comes to almost 20 persons of both sexes of various ages. Risberg decided that I must be stopped. But how? They still believed in my power as a goetic practitioner, and feared my demons, and feared infuriating Ortolan, who was enamoured of me. You were meant to be the solution. The Witcher. Geralt was breathing shallowly, and growing in optimism. His eyesight was much better, and the shivers were abating. He was immune to most known toxins, and the venom of the white scorpion, fatal to an ordinary mortal, was no exception, as it was fortunately turning out. The symptoms, which were dangerous at first, were weakening and fading with time, and it was turning out that the witch's body was capable of neutralizing the poison quite quickly. Dagerlund didn't know that, or in his conceitedness was underestimating it. "I found out they planned to send you to get me. I got slightly cold feet, I don't deny it, since I'd heard this and that about witches, and about you in particular. I ran to Ortolan as quickly as I could, crying, 'Save me, my beloved master!' My beloved master first told me off and muttered something about killing woodcutters being very naughty, that it wasn't nice, and that it was to be the last time. But then he advised me how to trick you and lure you into a trap. How to capture you, using a teleportational sigil that I had tattooed on my manly chest a few years ago. He forbade me, however, from killing you. Don't think that it's out of kindness. He needs your eyes. To be precise, the tapetum lucidum, the layer of tissue lining the inside of your eyeballs. A tissue that reflects and intensifies the light directed at the photoreceptor cells, thanks to which you can see at night and in the dark like a cat. Ortolan's newest idée fixe is to equip the whole of humanity with the ability to see like cats. As part of the preparations for such a lofty goal, he intends to graft your tapetum lucidum onto some other mutation he's creating, and the tissue for the implant must be taken from a live donor." Geralt cautiously moved his fingers and hand. "Ortolan, an ethical and merciful mage, intends, in his boundless goodness, to spare your life after removing your eyeballs. He thinks that it's better to be blind than deceased. Furthermore, he hesitates at the thought of causing pain to your lover, Yennefer of Vengerberg, for whom he feels a great and, in his case, strange affection. On top of that, he, Ortolan, is now close to completing a magical regenerational formula. In several years, you'll be able to report to him, and he'll restore your eyesight. Are you pleased? No? And rightly. What? Do you want to say something? Please speak." Geralt pretended to be having difficulty moving his lips. Actually, he didn't have to pretend at all. Dagerlund raised himself from his chair and leaned over him. "I can't understand anything." He grimaced. "In any case, what you have to say doesn't interest me much. Whereas I, indeed, still have something to announce to you. So know that clairvoyance is among my numerous talents. I can see quite clearly that when Ortolan restores your freedom to you as a blind man, Boo and Bang will be waiting for you, and you will land up in my laboratory, definitively this time. I shall vivisect you, mainly for pleasure, although I'm also a little curious as to what's inside you. When I finish, however, I shall, to use the terminology of the abattoir, portion you up. I shall send your remains piece by piece to Risberg as a warning of what befalls my foes. Let them see." Geralt gathered all his strength. There wasn't much of it. "But where Yennefer is concerned..." The sorcerer leaned over even closer. The witcher could smell his minty breath. "Unlike Ortolan, the thought of causing her suffering pleases me inordinately. Thus, I shall cut off the part that she valued most in you. I shall send it to her. In Vengab..." Geralt placed his fingers in a sign and touched the sorcerer's face. Sorrel Dagerlund choked and drooped on the chair. He snorted. His eyes had sunk deep into his skull. His head lolled on his shoulder. The medallion chain slipped from his limp fingers. Geralt leapt to his feet, or rather tried to. The only thing he managed to do was to fall from the chair onto the floor, his head right in front of Dagerlund's shoe. The sorcerer's medallion was in front of his nose, with a blue enamel dolphin neant on a golden oval, the emblem of Kerak. He didn't have time either to be surprised or to think about it. Dagerlund began to wheeze loudly. It was apparent he was about to awaken. The Somne sign had been effective, but faint and fleeting. The witcher was too weakened by the effect of the venom. He stood up, holding onto the table, knocking the books and scrolls from it. Pastor burst into the room. Geralt didn't even try to use a sign. He grabbed a leather and brass brand grimoire from the table and struck the hunchback in the throat with it. Pasta sat down heavily on the floor, dropping the arbalest. The Witcher hit him one more time and would have repeated it, but the incunable slipped from his numb fingers. He seized a carafe standing on the books and shattered it on Pasta's forehead. The hunchback, although covered in blood and red wine, didn't yield. He rushed at Geralt, not even brushing the slivers of crystal from his eyelids.
"Boo!"
he yelled, grabbing the Witcher by the knees.
"Bang! Get to me! Get to..."
Geralt seized another grimoire from the table. It was heavy, with a binding encrusted with fragments of a human skull. He slammed the hunchback with it, sending bone splinters flying in all directions. Dagoland spluttered, fighting to raise a hand. Geralt realized he was trying to cast a spell. The growing thud of heavy feet indicated that Boo and Bang were approaching. Pastor scrambled up from the floor, fumbling around, searching for the crossbow. Geralt saw his sword on the table and seized it. He staggered, almost falling over. He grasped Dagoland by the collar and pressed the blade against his throat.
"Your sigil!" he screamed into his ear. "Teleport us out of here!"
Boo and Bang, armed with scimitars, collided with each other in the doorway and got caught there, jammed solid. Neither of them thought of letting the other one through. The doorframe creaked.
"Teleport us!"
Geralt grabbed Dagoland by the hair, bending his head backwards.
"Now, or I'll slit your throat!"
Boo and Bang stumbled out of the doorway, taking the frame with them. Pastel found the crossbow and raised it. Dagoland opened his shirt with trembling hand and shrieked out a spell. But before the darkness engulfed them, he broke free of the Witcher and pushed him away. Geralt caught him by a lace cuff and tried to pull the sorcerer towards him. But at that moment, the portal was activated, and all his senses, including touch, vanished. He felt an elemental force sucking him in, jerking him, and spinning him as though in a whirlpool. The cold was numbing. For a split second. One of the longer and more ghastly split seconds of his life. He thudded against the ground, on his back. He opened his eyes. Black gloom. Impenetrable darkness was all around him.
"I've gone blind," he thought. "Have I lost my sight?"
He hadn't. It was simply a very dark night. His tapetum lucidum, as Dagoland had eruditely named it, had started working, picking up all the light there was in those conditions. A moment later, he recognized around him the outlines of some tree trunks, bushes or undergrowth. And above his head, when the clouds parted, he saw stars. Interlude. The following day. You had to hand it to them. The builders of Findertown knew their trade and hadn't been idle. In spite of having seen them in action several times, Shevlov watched in fascination as they assembled the pile driver again. The three connected timbers formed a tripod, at the top of which a pulley was hung. A rope was tossed over the pulley, and a heavy metal-edged block, called a ram in the builder's jargon, was fastened to it. Shouting rhythmically, the builders tugged on the line, lifting the ram right to the top of the tripod, then quickly released it. The ram fell heavily onto a post positioned in the hole, forcing it deep into the ground. It took three, at most four, blows of the ram for the pile to be standing securely. The builders swiftly dismantled the tripod and loaded the parts onto a wagon, during which time one of them climbed up a ladder and nailed an enamel plaque with the Redanian coat of arms, a silver eagle on a red field, to the post. Thanks to Shevlov and his free company, and also to the pile drivers and their operation, the province of Riverside, part of the Kingdom of Redania, had increased in area that day, quite significantly. The foreman walked over, wiping his forehead with his cap. He was in a sweat, although he hadn't done anything, unless you count effing and blinding. Shevlov knew what the foreman would ask, because he did so each time.
"Where's the next one going, Commander?"
"I'll show you."
Shevlov reined his horse around.
"Follow me."
The carters lashed the oxen, and the builders' vehicles moved sluggishly along the ridge, along ground somewhat softened by the recent storm. They soon found themselves by the next post, which was decorated with a black plaque, painted with lilies. The post was lying on the ground, having been previously rolled into the bushes. Shevlov's crew had made sure of that.
"Here's our progress triumph," thought Shevlov. "Here's our technical thought triumph."
The hand sunk Temerian posts could be torn out and tossed down in a trice. The Redanian post, driven in by a pile-driver, couldn't be pulled out of the ground so easily. He waved a hand, indicating the direction to the builders. A few furlongs south, beyond the village. The residents of the village, insofar as a handful of shacks and huts could be called a village, had already been driven onto the green by Shevlov's riders, and were scurrying around, raising dust, being pushed back by the horses. The always hot-headed Ishkairak wasn't sparing them the bullwhip. Others spurred their horses around the homesteads. Dogs barked, women wailed, and children bawled. Three riders trotted over to Shevlov. Jan Malkin, as skinny as a rake and nicknamed Poker, Prospero Basti, better known as Sperry, and Ayach Mordu, nicknamed Frigga on a grey mare.
"They are gathered together as you ordered," said Frigga, pushing back a lynx fur kalpak. "The entire hamlet."
"Silence them."
The crowd were quietened, not without the help of knouts and staves. Shevlov went closer.
"What do you call this dump?"
"Wood End."
"Wood End again?
These peasants don't have a scrap of imagination. Lead the builders on, Sperry. Show them where they're to drive in the post, because they'll get the place wrong again."
Sperry whistled, reining his horse around. Shevlov rode over to the huddled villagers. Frigga and Poker flanked him.
"Dwellers of Wood End."
Shevlov stood up in the stirrups.
"Heed what I say. By the will and order of His Majesty, by grace here reigning, King Vizimir, I inform you that this day the land up to the border posts belongs to the kingdom of Redania, and His Majesty King Vizimir is your lord and monarch. You owe him honour, obedience, and levies. And you're behind with your rent and taxes. By order of the king, you are to settle your debts immediately, into this here bailiff's coffer."
"How so?" yelled a man in the crowd. "What do you mean, pay? We paid. You've already fleeced us for levies."
"Temeria bailiffs fleeced you, and illegally, for this is not Temeria, but Redania. Look where the posts are."
"But yesterday it was still Temeria,"
howled one of the settlers.
"How can it be? We paid as they ordered." "You have no right."
"Who?" roared Shevlov. "Who said that? It is my right. I have a royal decree. We are royal troops. I said whoever wants to stay on their farm must pay the levies to the last penny. Any who resist will be banished. You paid Temeria, so you clearly think yourselves Temerians. Then scram, get over the border, but only with what you can carry, because your farms and livestock belong to Redania."
"Robbery! That's robbery and plunder!"
yelled a large peasant with a shock of hair, stepping forward.
"And you aren't a king's man, but a brigand. You have no
Ishkairak rode over and lashed the loudmouth with a bullwhip. The loudmouth fell. Others were quelled with pikestaffs. Shevlov's company knew how to cope with peasants. They had been moving the border for a week and had pacified plenty of settlements.
"Someone's approaching at speed,"
Frigga indicated with her scourge.
"Will it be fish?"
"And none other."
Shevlov shielded his eyes.
"Have that freak taken from the wagon and hand her over. And you, take a few of the boys and ride around the place. Various odd settlers remain dotted throughout the clearings and logging sites. You need to inform them as well to whom they're now paying rent. Should anyone offer resistance, you know what to do."
Frigga smiled evilly, flashing her teeth. Shevlov sympathized with the settlers she'd be visiting, although their fate didn't bother him much. He glanced up at the sun.
"We must hurry," he thought. "It'll be worth knocking down a few Temerian posts before noon, and driving in a few of ours.
You, Poker, follow me. Let's ride out to meet our guests."
There were two guests. One was wearing a straw hat, had prominent jawbones and a jutting-out chin, and his whole face was blue with several days' beard. The second was powerfully built, a veritable giant.
"Fish! Sergeant!"
That annoyed Shevlov. Javil Fish, not without reason, had brought up their old friendship, the times when they had served together in the regular army. Shevlov didn't like to be reminded of those days. He didn't want to be reminded about Fish, about serving, about his non-commissioned officer's pay.
"Free company?"
Fish nodded towards the village, from where yells and crying reached them.
"Busy, I see. punitive expedition, is it? Will you be doing some burning?
That's my business.
I won't be, he thought, with regret, because he liked burning down villages, and the company did too. But he had no orders to do so. The orders were to redraw the border and collect levies from the settlers. Drive away insubordinate individuals, but not touch goods or property, for they would serve the new settlers who would be brought there, from the north, where it was crowded even on barren land.
I caught the freak and I'm holding her, he declared, as ordered, tied up. It wasn't easy. Had I known, I would have asked for more. But we agreed on 500, so I'm due 500.
Fish nodded, and the giant rode up and gave Shevlov 2 plump purses. He had a viper curled around a dagger blade tattooed on his forearm. Shevlov knew that tattoo. A horseman from the company appeared with a captive. The freak had a sack over her head, reaching her knees, with a cord restraining her arms. Bare legs as thin as rakes protruded from the sack.
What's this?
Fish pointed at the captive.
My dear sergeant, 500 Novigradian crowns? Bit steep for a pig in a poke.
The sack comes free, replied Shevlov coldly. Like this good advice. Don't untie her and don't look inside.
Why?
It's risky. She bites and might cast a spell.
The giant slung the captive across his saddle. The freak, until then calm, struggled, kicked and howled in the sack. It was very little use, as the sack was holding her fast.
How do I know it is what I'm paying for? Asked Fish, and not some chance made, like from this here village.
Are you accusing me of lying?
Not in the least,
Fish appeased him, helped by the sight of Poker stroking the shaft of a battle axe hanging from his saddle.
I believe you, Shevlov. I know I can count on you. I mean, we're mates, aren't we?
From the good old days? I'm in a hurry, Fish. Duty calls.
Farewell. Sergeant?
I wonder, said Poker, watching them riding away. I wonder what they want of her. That freak, you didn't ask.
I didn't, Shevlov confessed coldly, because you don't ask about things like that.
He pitied the freak a little, but he wasn't too bothered about her fate. He guessed it would be miserable. Chapter 12. A signpost stood at the crossroads, a post with planks nailed to it, indicating the 4 points of the compass. Dawn found him where he had landed, tossed out of the portal on the dew-soaked grass, in a thicket beside a swamp or small lake, teeming with birds, whose gaggling and quacking roused him from his sound and exhausting sleep. He had drunk a witch's elixir during the night. He always made sure to keep some on him, in a silver tube in a hiding place sewn into his belt. The elixir, called Golden Oriole, was used as a panacea which was particularly effective against every kind of poisoning, infections, and the action of all kinds of venoms and toxins. Golden Oriole had saved Geralt more often than he could remember, but drinking the elixir had never caused the effects it had that night. For an hour after drinking it, he had fought cramps and extremely powerful vomiting reflexes, aware that he couldn't let himself be sick. As a result, although he had won the battle, he fell wearily into a deep sleep, which may also have been a consequence of the combination of the scorpion's venom, the elixir, and the teleportational journey. As far as the journey was concerned, he wasn't certain what had happened, how and why the portal opened by Degerland had spat him out here, onto the boggy wilderness. He doubted whether the sorcerer had done that deliberately. More likely it was simply a teleportational failure. Something he had been afraid of for a week. Something he had heard about many times, and had witnessed several times, when a portal, instead of sending the traveller where they were meant to go, threw them out somewhere else in a totally unexpected place. When he came to his senses, he was holding his sword in his right hand, and in his clenched left hand he had a shred of material, which he identified in the morning light as a shirt sleeve. The material was cut through cleanly, as though by a knife. It didn't bear the marks of blood, however, so the teleportal hadn't cut off the sorcerer's hand, but only his shirt, Geralt realized with regret. The worst portal failure Geralt had witnessed, which had forever discouraged him from teleportation, had occurred at the beginning of his witcher career. At that time, a fashion for being transported from place to place had prevailed among the nouveau riche. Wealthy lordlings and gilded youth, and some sorcerers offered such entertainment for astronomical sums. One day, the witcher happened to have been there. A teleportation enthusiast had appeared in a portal, bisected precisely down the middle. He looked like an open double bass case. Then everything flopped out of him and poured down. Fascination with teleportals decreased perceptibly after that accident.
Compared to something like that, he thought, landing on a marsh was quite simply a luxury.
He still hadn't fully regained his strength, was still experiencing dizziness and nausea. But there was no time to rest. He knew that portals left tracks, and sorcerers had ways of tracking the path of the teleportal. Although, if, as he suspected, there was a flaw in the portal, tracking his flight would be virtually impossible. But in any case, remaining for too long in the proximity of the landing place wouldn't be prudent. He set off at a brisk pace to get warm and loosen up.
It began with the swords, he thought, splashing through a puddle. How had Dandelion expressed it? It's a streak of bad luck and unlucky incidents. First, I lost the swords. It's barely 3 weeks later, and now I've lost my mount. Roach, who I left in Pine Tops, is sure to be eaten by wolves, presuming somebody doesn't find and steal her. The swords. The horse. What next? I dread to think.
After an hour of traipsing through the marsh, he emerged onto drier ground, and after another hour happened upon a tramped-down highway, and reached the crossroads after half an hour's march along it. A signpost stood at the crossroads, a post with planks nailed to it, indicating the four points of the compass. They had all been shat on by birds of passage and copiously dotted by crossbow bolt holes. It appeared that every traveller felt duty-bound to shoot at the signpost. In order then to decipher the words, one had to approach quite close. The witcher went over and decoded the directions. The plank pointing westwards, according to the position of the sun, bore the name of Chipira, and the opposite one pointed to Tegmont. The third plank indicated the way to Findatan, while the fourth, God knew where, because someone had covered the lettering in pitch. In spite of that, Geralt already more or less knew where he was. The teleport had tossed him out on the marsh created by two branches of the River Pontar. The southern branch, owing to its size, had even been given its own name by cartographers, and thus appeared on many maps as the Embla. The land lying between the branches, or rather the scrap of land, was called Emblonia. At least it had been once, and quite a long time ago had stopped being called anything. The kingdom of Emblonia had ceased to exist around half a century before, and there were reasons for that. In most kingdoms, duchies, and other forms of government and social communities in the lands Geralt knew, things were in order and in fairly good shape, it would be reasonable to state. Admittedly, the system faltered occasionally, but it functioned. In the vast majority of the social communities, the ruling class ruled, rather than just stealing and organizing by turns, gambling and prostitution. Only a small percentage of the social elite consisted of people who thought that hygiene was a prostitute and gonorrhea a member of the Lark family. Only a small number of the labouring and farming folk were morons, who lived solely for today and today's vodka, incapable of comprehending with their vestigial intellects something as incomprehensible as tomorrow and tomorrow's vodka. Most of the priests didn't corrupt miners or swindle money out of the people, but dwelt in temples, devoting themselves wholly to attempts at fathoming the insoluble mysteries of their faith. Psychopaths, freaks, oddballs and dullards kept away from politics and important positions in the government and administration, busying themselves instead with the ruination of their own personal lives. Village idiots hunkered down behind barns and didn't try to act as tribunes of the people. Thus it was in most states. But the kingdom of Emblonia wasn't part of the majority. It was a minority in all the above-mentioned respects, and in many others. Hence it fell into decline, and finally disappeared. So its powerful neighbours, Temeria and Redania, fought over it. Emblonia, though a politically inept creation, possessed certain wealth, for it lay in the alluvial valley of the River Pontar, which for centuries had deposited silt there, carried by floods. Fen soil, an extremely fertile and agriculturally high-yield variety, was formed from the silt. Under the rule of Emblonia's kings, the fen soil began to turn into a swampy wasteland, on which little could be grown, much less harvested. Meanwhile, Temeria and Redania were recording considerable increases in population, and agricultural production had become a matter of vital importance. Emblonia's fen soil tempted. So, the two kingdoms divided by the River Pontar carved up Emblonia between themselves without further ado, and struck its name from the map. The part annexed by Temeria was called Pontaria, and what fell to Redania became Riverside. Hordes of settlers were brought in to work the soil. Under the gaze of able stewards, and owing to judicious agriculture and drainage, the region, though small, soon became a veritable agrarian horn of plenty. Disputes also quickly sprang up, becoming more heated the more abundant became the harvests yielded by the Pontarian fen soil. The treaty demarcating the border between Temeria and Redania contained clauses permitting all sorts of interpretations, and the maps appended to the treaty were useless because the cartographers botched their work. The river itself also played a part. After periods of heavy rain, it would alter and move its course by 2 or even 3 miles. And so the Horn of Plenty turned into a bone of contention. The plans for dynastic marriages and alliances came to naught, and diplomatic notes, tariff wars and trade embargoes began. The border conflicts grew stronger, and bloodshed seemed inevitable, then finally occurred, and continued to occur regularly. In his wanderings in search of work, Geralt usually avoided places beset by armed clashes, because it was difficult to find a job. Having experienced regular armies, mercenaries and marauders once or twice, the farmers became convinced that werewolves, striggers, trolls under bridges and barrow whites were actually trifling problems and minor threats, and that, by and large, hiring a witcher was a waste of money, and that there were more urgent matters like, say, rebuilding a cottage burned down by the army, and buying new hens to replace the ones the soldiers had stolen and devoured. For these reasons, Geralt was unfamiliar with the lands of Emblonia, or Pontaria and Riverside, according to more recent maps. He didn't especially have any idea which of the places named on the signpost were closer, and where he ought to head from the crossroads in order to bid farewell to the wilderness as quickly as possible, and greet any kind of civilization again. Geralt decided on Findatan, which meant heading north, for more or less in that direction lay Novigrad, where he had to get to if he was to recover his swords, and by the 15th of July at that. After around an hour of brisk marching, he walked right into what he had so wanted to avoid. There was a thatched peasant homestead and several shacks close to the logging site. The fact that something was occurring there was being announced by the loud barking of a dog and the furious clucking of poultry, the screaming of a child and the crying of a woman, and swearing. He approached, cursing under his breath both his ill luck and his scruples. Feathers were flying, and an armed man was tying a fowl to his saddle. Another was thrashing a peasant cringing on the ground with a scourge. Another was struggling with a woman in torn clothing and the child hanging on to her. He walked up, and without thinking twice or speaking, seized the raised hand holding the scourge and twisted. The armed man howled. Geralt shoved him against the wall of a henhouse. He hauled the other one away from the woman by the collar and pushed him up against the fence. "Begone," he stated curtly. "This minute." He quickly drew his sword as a sign for them to treat him in accordance with the gravity of the situation, and remind them emphatically of the possible consequences of wrong-headed behaviour. One of the armed men laughed loudly. The other joined in, taking hold of his sword hilt. "Who are you, assaulted vagabond? Do you seek death?" "Be gone," I said. The armed soldier tying on the fowl turned around from the horse and was revealed to be a woman. A pretty one, in spite of her unpleasantly narrowed eyes. "Had enough of life?" It turned out the woman was able to contort her lips even more grotesquely. "Or perhaps you're retarded. Perhaps you can't count. I'll help you. There's only one of you. There are three of us. Meaning you're outnumbered. Meaning you ought to turn around and sod off as fast as your legs can carry you, while you still have any." "Be gone. I won't say it again." "Aha! Three people are a piece of cake to you. And a dozen?" The sound of hooves thudding. The witcher looked around. 9 armed riders. Pikes and bear spears were pointed at him. "You! Good for nothing. Drop your sword." He ignored the instruction, and dodged towards the henhouse to have some protection at his back.
"What's going on, Frigga?"
"This settler is resisting," snorted the woman addressed as Frigga, "claiming that he won't pay the levy because he's already paid it, blah, blah, blah. So, we decided to teach the off some sense, and then suddenly this grey-haired fellow sprang up from nowhere. A knight, it turns out, a noble man, a defender of the poor and oppressed. Just him alone, and he went for our throats."
"So I spirited," chortled one of the horsemen,
advancing on Geralt and aiming his pike at him.
"Let's have him dance a jig." "Drop your sword," ordered a horseman in a plumed beret,
who seemed to be the commander.
"Sword on the ground." "Shall I spear him, Shevlov?" "Leave him, Sperry."
Shevlov looked down on the witcher from the saddle.
"You won't drop your sword, eh?" he commented. "Are you such a hero? Such a hard man? You eat oysters in their shells, washed down with turpentine. Bow down before no one, and only stand up for the unjustly accused. Are you so sensitive to wrongs?" "We'll find out. Poker, Legenza, Flocket."
The three armed soldiers obeyed their leader at once, clearly having experience in that regard. They dismounted, their movements well drilled. One of them held a knife to the settler's throat, the other yanked the woman by the hair, and the third grabbed the child. The child began yelling.
"Drop your sword," said Shevlov. "This second, or... Legenza, slit the peasant's throat."
Geralt dropped his sword. They immediately leapt on him, pressing him against the planks and menacing him with their blades.
"Aha!" said Shevlov, dismounting. "Success! You're in trouble, peasant champion," he added dryly. "You've obstructed and sabotaged a royal detachment, and I have orders to arrest and put before the courts anyone guilty of that." "Arrest?" the man named Legenza scowled. "Burden ourselves? Throw a noose around his neck and string him up, and that's that. Or cut him to pieces on the spot." "I've seen this fella before," one of the riders suddenly said. "He's a witcher." "A what?" "A witcher. A wizard, making his living killing monsters for money."
"A wizard? Kill him before he casts a spell on us."
"Shut up, Iskyric. Speak, Trent. Where did you see him, and in what circumstances?"
"It was in Maribor, in the service of a castellan there, who had hired him to kill some beast. I don't recall what, but I remember him for his white hair."
"Ah, so if he attacked us, somebody must have hired him to."
"Monsters are witches' work. They just defend people from monsters."
"Aha!"
Frigga pushed back her lynx fur kalpak.
"I said so. A defender. He saw Legenza flogging the peasant, and Floquet making ready to ravish that woman." "And categorized you correctly," Shevlov snorted, "as monsters. So, you were lucky." "Oh, jest. Because the matter is simple, it seems to me. When serving in the army, I heard something quite different about witches. They hire themselves out for everything. To spy, to guard, even to assassinate. They called them the cats. Trent saw this one here in Maribor, in Temeria, meaning he's a Temerian hireling, employed regarding the border posts. They warned me in Findertown about Temerian mercenaries and are promising a bounty for any caught. So, let's take him in fetters to Findertown, turn him into the commandant and claim the reward. Come on, tie him up. What are you waiting for? Are you afraid? He's not offering resistance. He knows what we'd do to the little peasants if he tries anything.
And who's going to fucking touch him if he's a wizard?" "Knock on wood."
Legenza spat on the ground.
"Lily-livered cowards,"
yelled Frigga, untying the strap of her saddlebags.
"Yellow bellies. I'll do it, since no one here has the balls."
Geralt allowed himself to be tied up. He decided to comply, for the time being. Two ox wagons trundled out of the forest, wagons laden with posts and elements of some kind of wooden construction.
"Someone go to the carpenters and the bailiff," Shevlov pointed. "Send them back. We've sunk enough posts, it'll suffice for now. We shall take a rest here, meanwhile. Search the farmyard for anything fit as fodder for the horses, and some victuals for us."
Legenza picked up and examined Geralt's sword, Dandelion's acquisition. Shevlov snatched it out of his hand. He hefted it, wielded it, and whirled it around.
"You were lucky we came in force," he said. "He would have called you up no problem. You, Frigga and Flocket. Legends circulate about these witches' swords. The best steel, oftentimes folded and forged again. And they're protected by special spells, thus achieving exceptional tensile strength and sharpness. A witcher edge, I tell you, pierces armour plate and mail like a linen sheet, and cuts through every other blade like noodles." "That cannot be," stated Sperry.
Like many of the others, his whiskers were dripping with the cream they had found in the cottage and guzzled.
"Not like noodles."
"I can't believe it either," added Frigga. "Difficult to believe something like that,"
threw in Poker.
"Really?"
Shevlov assumed a swordsman's pose.
"Face me, one of you, and we find out. Come on, who's willing?" "Well? Why has it gone so quiet?"
"Very well."
Ishgairak stepped forward and drew his sword.
"I shall face you. What do I care? We shall see whether..." "En garde, Shevlov."
"En garde. 1, 2, 3!
The swords struck each other with a clang. The metal whined mournfully as it snapped. Frigga ducked as a broken piece of blade whistled past her temple.
"Fuck!"
said Shevlov, staring disbelievingly at the blade, which had broken a few inches above the gilded crossguard.
"I'm not a notch on mine!"
Ishgairak raised his sword.
"Not a notch! Not even a mark!"
Frigga giggled like a schoolgirl. Legenza bleated like a billy goat. The rest guffawed.
"Witcher sword," snorted Sperry. "Cut through like noodles. You're a fucking noodle. It's..."
Shevlov pursed his lips.
"It's sodding scrap. It's trash. And you..."
He tossed away the remains of the sword, glowered at Geralt, and pointed an accusing finger at him.
"You're a fraudster. An imposter and a fraudster. You feign to be a witcher and wield such trash. You carry junk like this instead of a decent blade. How many good people have you deceived, I wonder? How many paupers have you fleeced, swindler? Oh, you'll confess your peccadilloes in Findertown. The Starostin will see to that."
He panted, spat, and stamped his foot.
"To horse! Let's get out of here!"
They rode away, laughing, singing, and whistling. The settler and his family gloomily watched them go. Geralt saw their lips moving. It wasn't difficult to guess what fate and what mishaps they were wishing on Shevlov and company. The settler couldn't have expected in his wildest dreams that his wishes would come true to the letter, and that it would happen so swiftly. They arrived at the crossroads. The highway leading westwards along the ravine was rutted by wheels and hooves. The carpenter's wagons had clearly gone that way, as did the company. Geralt walked behind Frigga's horse, tied to a rope attached to the pommel of her saddle. The horse of Shevlov, who was riding at the front, whinnied and reared up. Something suddenly flared on the side of the ravine, lit up, and became a milky, iridescent globe. Then the globe vanished, and a strange group appeared in its stead. There were several figures embraced and intertwined together.
"What the devil?"
cursed Poker, and rode over to Shevlov, who was quietening down his horse.
"What's going on?"
The group separated into four figures. A slim, long-haired and slightly effeminate man, two long-armed giants with bow legs, and a hunched dwarf with a great double-limbed steel arbalest.
"Draw your weapons!"
yelled Shevlov.
"Draw your weapons! Stand your ground!"
First one, and then the other bowstring of the great arbalest clanged. Shevlov died at once from a bolt to the head. Poker looked down at his belly, through which a bolt had just passed, before he fell from his saddle.
"Fight!"
The company drew their swords as one.
"Fight!"
Geralt had no intention of standing idly by to wait for the result of the engagement. He formed his fingers in the Igni sign and burned through the rope binding his arms. He caught Frigga by the belt and hurled her to the ground and leapt into the saddle. There was a blinding flash and the horses began to neigh, kick and thrash the air with their forehooves. Several horsemen fell and screamed as they were trampled. Frigga's grey mare also bolted before the Witcher could bring her under control. Frigga leapt up, jumped and seized the bridle and reins. Geralt drove her away with a punch and spurred the mare into a gallop. Pressed to the steed's neck, he didn't see Degerlund frightening the horses and blinding their riders with magical lightning bolts, or see Boo and Bang falling on the horsemen, roaring, one with a battle axe, the other with a broad scimitar. He didn't see the splashes of blood, didn't hear the screams of the slaughtered. He didn't see Ishgairak die, and immediately after him, Sperry, filleted like a fish by Bang. He didn't see Boo fell Flocket and his steed, and then drag him out from under the horse. But Flocket's stifled cry, the sound of a rooster being butchered, lingered long, until he turned from the highway and dashed into the forest.
Mahakam potato soup is prepared thus. Gather chanterelles in the summer and men on horseback in the autumn. If it is the winter or early spring, take a sizable handful of dried mushrooms. Put them in a pan and cover them with water. Soak them overnight, salt them in the morning, toss in half an onion and boil. Drain them, but do not discard the broth. Instead, be vigilant in removing the sand that has surely settled at the bottom of the pan. Boil the potatoes and dice them. Take some fatty bacon, chop and fry it. Cut the onion into half slices and fry them in the bacon fat until they almost stick. Take a great cauldron, toss everything into it, not forgetting the chopped mushrooms. Pour on the mushroom broth, add water as needs be. Pour on sour rice starter to taste. How to execute the starter may be found elsewhere in another receipt. Boil and season with salt, pepper and marjoram according to taste and liking. Add melted fat back. Stirring in cream is a matter of taste, but heed, it is against our dwarven tradition, for it is a human fashion to add cream to potato soup.
Eleonora Rudurin Piggott.
Perfect Mahakam cuisine, the precise science of cooking and making dishes from meats, fishes and vegetables. Also, seasoning diverse sauces, baking cakes, making jam, preparing cooked meats, preserves, wine, spirits, and various useful cooking and preserving secrets. Essential for every good and thrifty housewife.
Chapter 13. Like almost all post stations, this one was located at a junction where two roads intersected. It was a building with a shingle roof and a columned arcade with an adjoining stable and woodshed, set among white-barked birches. It was empty. There seemed to be no guests nor travellers. The exhausted grey mare stumbled, walking stiffly and unsteadily, her head hanging almost to the ground. Geralt led her and handed the reins over to the stable lad. He looked about 40 and was bent over under the burden of his years. He stroked the mare's neck and examined his hand. He looked Geralt up and down, then spat right between his feet. Geralt shook his head and sighed. It didn't surprise him. He knew he was at fault, that he'd overdone it with the gallop, and over difficult terrain, what's more. He'd wanted to get as far away as possible from Sorrel Degerlund and his minions. He was aware that it was a woeful justification. He also had a low opinion of people who drove their mounts into the ground. The stable lad went away, leading the mare and muttering to himself. It wasn't difficult to guess what he was muttering and what he thought. Geralt sighed, pushed the door open, and entered the station. It smelled agreeable inside, and the Witcher realized he hadn't eaten for more than a day.
"There's no horse,"
said the postmaster, emerging from behind the counter and anticipating his question.
"And the next mail coach won't be here for 2 days."
"I could use some food."
Geralt looked upwards at the ridge and rafters of the high vault.
"I'll pay."
"We have none."
"Oh, come, postmaster," came a voice from the corner of the chamber. "Does it behove you to treat a traveller so?"
In the corner, seated at a table, was a dwarf. Flaxen-haired and flaxen-bearded, he was dressed in an embroidered patterned maroon jerkin, embellished with brass buttons on the front and sleeves. He had ruddy cheeks and a prominent nose. Geralt had occasionally seen unusually shaped, slightly pink potatoes at the market. The dwarf's nose was of an identical colour and shape.
"You offered me potato soup?"
The dwarf glared sternly at the postmaster from under very bushy eyebrows.
"You surely won't contend that your wife only prepares one portion of it. I'll wager any sum that it also suffices for this gentleman. Be seated, traveller. Will you take a beer?"
"With pleasure,"
"Thank you," replied Geralt, sitting down and digging out a coin from the hiding place in his belt.
"But allow me to treat you good, sir. Despite the misleading impression, I am neither a tramp nor a vagrant.